This is What Goddesses Watch, a film and TV podcast that takes a divinely badass dive into the feminine on screen. With me, Soma Ghosh, film critic and editor. And welcome to a very special What Goddesses Watch. I always say that. There's always something special about that episode, because there is. But as we head into winter, we're really warming up with two beautiful, unusual films from India, Sri Lanka, and Britain. And I have with me our very own audio producer, Quiva Lavelle, who is also an interdisciplinary artist and DJ living in Dublin, who is currently moonlighting as a reporter for RTE Lyric FM's Culture File, and has been a manager of two editions of the Gays International LGBTQ Plus Film Festival, and also of the Silk Road International Film Festival, and has appeared in and worked on many independent Irish films and the occasional mainstream too. Hi.
Hey there, Soma. Thanks for having me.
It's so fun. We've got you out from behind your decks.
Yes, I'm finally joining in the chat.
we'll see how it goes. We'll see if we're gonna let you out of your audio cage again. No, but with all of your writing and thinking around film as well as curating, I'm so pleased to have you for these two really unusual films. So we are talking about All We Imagine as Light, written and directed by Payal Kapadia, and The Taste of Mango, written and directed by Chloe Abrahams. That's what we're talking about today. And we were saying earlier that both of these films are quite unusual, and you were saying you weren't quite sure where they were going at the beginning. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I think like they don't set up too much in the, you know, first, I guess, kind of section for like both movies. Does a more kind of like tonal, moody kind of setting thing, which I do like.
These films have been very beloved, although we haven't got to see them on general release yet. So it's exciting that they are coming out. All We Imagine as Light by Payal Kapadia is in fact the first female Indian filmmaker to make it to an official selection for Cannes. And there was a wonderful moment when the whole team danced down the red carpet and there was a standing ovation. These two very unusual tales about female friendship and relationships that take us on a journey. They both take us on an emotional journey, and which can sometimes be brutal, sometimes tender, sometimes beautiful, and they take us on a journey of place. So we move in The Taste of Mango from a very cozy, feminine, middle-aged British suburbia to Sri Lanka. And of course, with All We Imagine as Light, there's that movement as well from Mumbai and all of the movement within Mumbai to the coast of Konkan. So Taste of Mango, one of the things I have to ask you just right at the top before I tell our listeners about the story is, what did you think, as a DJ of the Western Girls Collective, what did you make of the use of country and Western music in this film?
I thought it was lovely, because it was clearly a very personal thing. You can tell that it's kind of this thing that brings them all together. They all have this space where they cherish these songs. But like a lot of country Western songs are also very dark, you know, so I think there's quite a lot of storytelling of like female pain and how they've kind of like processed through these beautiful but, you know, very somber songs.
Yes, absolutely. And at the same time, I found it very charming, this juxtaposition of sometimes quite twee songs about I Never Promised You a Rose Garden with those songs about the brutality of what it takes to be a man and so on, and these typical country and Western songs of women, as you say, hard done by bad men, are giving us some telltale clues to this story, which is Chloe's own story. So
The director and writer, Chloe, who won Best Debut Director Award at the BIFA and Best Documentary Audience Award at the BFI London Film Festival, she is investigating the secret history of her own family in The Taste of Mango. So the three women whom we meet in this story are Chloe, her mother Rosanna, and her grandmother Jean. They come from a Christian Sri Lankan background, and Rosanna moved as a young woman to Britain, where Chloe was born, and we discover that she was running away from something. And so it's this thing that she was running away from that Chloe is investigating. And in terms of how then it uses those relationships, that's really interesting, isn't it? In terms of telling the story, how did you feel about the way that she photographs and films her mother and then her grandmother when Jean finally comes over to visit, when we know we very much take up this position of the child? Although Chloe is now a full-grown woman, she's often hanging over stairwells and overhearing her mother's phone calls to other members of the family. There's this mystery that she overhears about that man, who turns out to be a violently abusive stepfather to her mother, and that's just the beginning of it. So what did you think about the way that she is filming her own mother and her grandmother?
I thought it was incredibly brave as a thing to do, but also there's a kind of deceptive delicateness in how she approaches her mother and Jean, her grandmother, as well. When she starts unraveling Jean, it begins with these cozy shots of them hanging out in bed, and it's kind of probing in a way where it's not obvious, I guess, to kind of gently tease things out. So yeah, I thought it was very, very tender for how difficult or how heavy the trauma was. She's like a spy, you know.
I think that's right about the delicacy of the film. I was just so struck by how quiet it is. And that's very interesting. In contrast to, and I think we've kind of indicated that there's violence that is talked about in the film. It's not shown. And it's something that is being investigated. And we're going to try and not give too many spoilers here. But in contrast to rape dramas in culture that we see in culture, whether it's the National Theatre's Prima Facie or the recent TV series with Cate Blanchett, Disclaimer, there's no urgency here apart from the urgency of deep love. And I feel that the tone of the film makes a great deal of use of intimacy and fragility and piecing things together with those voyeuristic shots. And it moves from this very feminine, well, it doesn't really ever leave it, actually. It kind of keeps coming back to this very feminine, quiet world. You see all three generations in a bed together, right? And you see them drinking tea in bed. You see Rosanna dyeing her hair, touching up her roots. There are shots of acrylic nails cutting the mango of the title. And at the same time, there is this use of framing that's juxtaposed with shots of the natural world as well, that makes all this piecing together actually feel quite fragile. So although there is all of this cozy jollity, I really liked the photography around nature and what that had to say.
Yeah, I thought they were very, very sensory, like those shots you're saying with the nails and the cutting of the mango. It was just very, very poetic as a way of exploring, and as well the voiceovers as well, and the kind of memories coming back was a way to kind of, I guess, slow the pace as well, and kind of give these like periods of reflection of kind of these snatches of everyday life. But yeah, that's all kind of alongside the revealing or the kind of earwigging on why things aren't quite right, you know, and what they're not saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you found that it slowed things down, because I thought from the start that this gentle, meandering, handheld camera, the quiet voices gently confessing or going about their daily chores, that tone would then be cut against the movements in nature. So whether that was ants on a lemon sunshiny crumbly wall, suggesting that there are male parasites who prey on these beautiful women, that's something else to be said, that they're all very enjoyable individuals with a great deal of charm. The way that nature was used as a setting, including in Sri Lanka, with those beautiful nighttime shots of urban Sri Lanka and also of the rain-wet tarmac, the shiny train rails, the full silvery moon, you'd sense that there was this movement, there was this dynamism, there was this vitality, which also felt like it was there in the women, which you kind of really needed to know, was reassuring to know, and was struggling to break out. And then there'd be these very interesting cuts, so a cut from a moonlit Sri Lankan coastal night like that to Chloe attempting to confront Nana, her grandmother, about her rapist paedophile husband of 40 years. And in terms of characters, they had a similar sweetness to them, I thought. And yet, obviously, they're coming at the drama from different positions. Who was your favourite character and why?
My admiration for Chloe making this, I think, kind of frames a lot of it. But I do think Rosanna, because I guess you see this development of her position from this kind of meek, I don't want to upset anything in the family, you know, I think it's best we don't talk about anything, to eventually kind of coming to a position of, you know, when she's having that phone call saying that man, a bit more drawing of boundaries, and that she makes more of an admirable effort to protect her daughter. You know, there's a lot to be admired there.
Yeah, and she's just a very lovable, sweet, charming character with this playfulness, like when she dresses up as Marilyn Monroe on her mother's birthday, and this girlishness, and there is happiness in her life as well, but it's very, you know, it's very dappled, her experiences. But when she's asked about falling in love, there's this shy, excited laughter when she's asked, and we get to see her current golden bridal looks alongside her sort of frosted 80s wedding beauty. She's really quite stunning. So she's in the centre of the generations, and because she's the one who has been kind of particularly holding on to the secret and trying to protect her daughter and so on. How did you feel about the way that the story talked about sexual violence against women? It takes a very interesting route then. All of this gentleness, it contrasts very much with how we tend to see Western stories of Me Too, right?
Yeah, well, I think like you see the development of positions through the generations, through these three characters, but I think there is such a bleakness to Jean's, I guess, motto or mantra or whatever it is that she tells herself, that to expect anything is wrong, and you'll be disappointed, and you should just accept everything as it comes. It sounds almost kind of pleasant, like a pleasant and innocuous kind of thought at first, but then you also see where that kind of thinking leads. It's not just kind of left there, you see the damage of it.
I think that's a really good point. At the same time, I felt that I recognised the pressure of growing up in and being part of a patriarchal Asian society where it's almost expected that there might be some transgressions. It's not looked well upon. So Jean doesn't approve of the violence, and whether it's physical or sexual, of this husband, but far more concerned is she with what everybody will think. And I'm sure some of this obviously speaks to some of the Irish Catholic background as well. But there is this tremendous generosity that all three of them have in the way that they treat each other. And that also felt to me to be really recognisably Asian, that the attempt to somehow keep on providing support and be giving. Now, on the one hand, it's tricky, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you can say, oh, you know, mum, you're just, you know, you're not really somebody who gives unconditional love. It's more that you've been brainwashed into thinking that's all you can be and do. When you see how Rosanna gives both to her mother and her daughter, how in those playful moments of bringing out the birthday cake, dressing up, the little foil balloon that says Queen for a day, these many moments of hope and her delight in singing along to the 50s and 60s country and western songs, there is this very real sweetness and this very quite deep personality there that is not one that we often see in cinema. So I also loved Rosanna for that. And then, of course, Chloe herself. I found it interesting how much she smiles. Did you notice that? How they've all got this very pretty smile. And she says at one point, my mother told me that people comment that I've got the same smile as her, and my mother warned me to be careful about it. But Chloe is still smiling all the way through.
I think it is really beautiful that she is beaming throughout the film. But yeah, I was thinking about that comment about the smile, and I think it can be sometimes maybe a universal mothering thing of the kind of protective attack, like the world is going to do this to you, so I'll preemptively say, you know, you need to watch this, or this joy will get you in trouble somehow.
Yeah, and at the same time, each of them is very smiley. So at the same time, each of them performs the same feminine sweetness and genuinely are sweet. And it's very moving and interesting as to how Chloe finally makes her way to Jean's, you know, kind of last confession and kind of last stand, propelled through the other level of music, which is dreamy synth and electronic piano. There is this sense of movement given through the music and atmosphere of the film. And when we finally are in Sri Lanka, looking at the ocean and seeing the glowworms, there is that feeling of nature having this insinuating, alive presence that things stay the same, but things also change, which we can look at in All We Imagine as Light, which we're going to talk about next. But before we do that, what are our goddess votes for The Taste of Mango? So the top we can give is 5.
I think I would feel a 5, yeah, by the end of it. I cried, it got me. 5 goddesses.
So in tears by the end, yeah. And I think that I'm going to give it a 4.5. I loved it all the way through. I thought it was really daring and charming. It actually reminded me of lots of things about my own family and lots of women whom I recognised in it, whom I don't normally see on screen. So it's a fantastic debut. So moving on to All We Imagine as Light, written and directed by Payal Kapadia, in UK and Irish cinemas on the 29th of November. It's starring Kani Kasruthi as senior nurse Prabha, Divya Prabha as junior nurse Anu, and Chaya Kadam as the hospital canteen cook, Parvati. So, as it sounds, this is a tale of friendship between three women who are working in a Mumbai hospital, all struggling for personal freedom. Senior nurse Prabha's delicate peace of mind is troubled by the arrival of a gift from her estranged husband, a rice cooker, while she's being gently courted by a poetic doctor. Meanwhile, her junior nurse roommate, Anu, is struggling to find a place to finally have sex with her secret Muslim boyfriend. And their friend, canteen cook Parvati, is fighting eviction from her home and chasing the gundas from her door. So it's a fictional story shot in a, often, not always, in a documentary new wave style way. That, of course, brings out a universality that the stories of these women is in some ways the stories of the people of Mumbai and the people who are immigrating to Mumbai for work. But realism aside, or realism collides with a surprisingly magical twist, which we're not going to reveal, but a surprisingly magical twist at the climax of the film. It's really bold, yet gentle in so many of its artistic choices, one of which is the music. How did you like the music? So the music's right in there at the beginning, isn't it?
Yeah, I really liked the choices of music with this one. And it had a kind of like a screwball kind of Wong Kar-wai kind of feeling, sort of jazzy and atmospheric, especially with those kind of romantic scenes with Anu and her lover. So I really liked that as an approach. It seemed like a lovely kind of international cinema kind of lens to look at Mumbai as a city through.
Yeah, yeah. And it's actually, I was fascinated by how that, as you say, it's kind of, it's slightly kooky, wonky, you know, sort of feeling of it. It's a bit 60s jazz, it's a bit new wave, and yet there's also something really sort of rippling and hypnotic about it. Most of the music was actually composed by an Ethiopian nun, Emahoy Segue Mariam Guebru. So she's got a very interesting story of her own as a runaway, as somebody who also experienced being a prisoner of war, made music for Haile Selassie, and felt that she had this deep spiritual vocation and became a nun by the time that she was 21, and went on till 2023 at the age of 99 composing this music. And much of the music, which was put out in Germany and across Europe, the sales of that went to educating orphan children in Ethiopia. So that kind of feels a very apt choice. Do you know what I mean for this movie?
Yeah, it was beautiful. It just had a lovely kind of spell casting quality to it, and it's just so lovely with the shots of the city.
What did you make of how Mumbai is shown? So it's interesting the way that the film opens. The film opens like as if it's a documentary about Mumbai. It's not very much like Dublin. So what was your impression of Mumbai at first from the opening, and then how it's used throughout the film?
Yeah, I love the atmosphere of it. These kind of markets that only kind of come alive at night. I thought the lighting was just so gorgeous, like in so many different places. I also like the scenes of like traveling and the sense of distance between places, not just physical distance, but cultural distance. That's all kind of contained in the space.
This movie manages to, despite being fairly strongly located in just two places, so we're in Mumbai, and then the nurses manage to make it away to the coast, to Konkan, where Parvati has a place. But there is this peripatetic tone from the music, from the lights, from this presentation of Mumbai as this blue, red and yellow city. So you've got these primary colours, glassy urban reflections, shack housing, and this constant noise, whether it's the noise of traffic or of a jingle on somebody's phone, and the overlapping lives. I also just adored many of the simple shots of everybody travelling on trains, many of them sleeping, others, you know, holding onto their bags, others dreaming. And it feels like a city that is haunted. And these are stories of women who are haunted in different ways, right? Haunted by past relationships, haunted by a marriage that they can't quite get out of, haunted by the power of their domineering parents, in the case of Anu, who is the youngest. And another thing which I think that people who are not familiar with the Indian languages might miss is how many different languages are at play here. So again, I think that's something that we as bilingual speakers really appreciate about, how that gives us a different way of holding the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't have clocked it until until it was mentioned that the doctor, wasn't it, said, yeah, I'm not really feeling comfortable as a speaker of this language. That helped me to clock that he wasn't speaking his native tongue there. But yeah, it does kind of demonstrate all of the breadths of cultures that are going on there.
That's right. So we have Malayalam, we have Marathi, which is Parvathi is a native speaker, and English as a medium language, and Hindi, of course, as the main medium language. And so with those different levels, you also have a sense of different cultures between the friends, and particularly with the friends from South India and this lovely doctor. I love that character who writes poetry for Prabha and cooks her desserts. Oh my God, he's such a gorgeous man. But we do have this feeling of these overlapping languages, the fact that Mumbai is a place where you can lose yourself, that it's a place where we are told explicitly that you better get used to impermanence. It's a place where there's work and money, but also loneliness and noise. And so when you hear the other immigrants as well, and there are other languages spoken from around India, like my own Bengali, you hear these different tales of how people have come to the city. The changeability and that mutability that cities offer is really present in the setting. So there are these relationships between the women, and then there are relationships between the men and women. So which relationship did you care about the most, and why?
I guess Anu's relationship, because of how it was told. I don't know, those scenes where they're finding places to smooch and starts pouring rain, and it's just this misty, splashy blue, the precarity of where they're kind of trying to plant their romantic scenes, and this kind of feeling like they're being watched as well. I loved as well when they had that scene in the Cave of Icons. They just kind of have gone from, I guess, this kind of very passionate sexual attraction to kind of moving through to having these like deep conversations about what their relationship really is. And then another gorgeous lovemaking scene then after that. So yeah, they won me over.
But we have to remember that in the history of Indian cinema, we actually have the longest screen kiss in the movie Karma. And there are also some fantastic films from sort of like the late 70s, as you might think, as there also were in New York and around, obviously. Well, you know, it's very, very hopefully called Free Love, but let's just say around sexuality and feminism, iconic scenes of things like post-coital cigarettes being shared between Parveen Bibi and Amitabh Bachchan in Deewar. And here we have something very different and very gorgeously sweet, because we have this young couple who, I don't know how clear it is to non-Indian viewers, are breaking a lot of taboos in terms of moving across cultures. He's a Muslim. She at one point buys a hijab as part of the attempt to smuggle into a place to have sex. And yet at the same time, they're trying to redefine what erotic closeness can be, right?
Yeah, I was actually kind of relieved that didn't work out, her wearing the hijab to go in and get the ride. I don't know, I think it said a lot that she was willing to do it, but I almost felt relieved that I didn't have to see that happen.
Yes, okay. And I also take your point about the voyeuristic shots when they are trying to get it on in a car park or whatever, that there is a sense of dread, although fortunately we are ending today's show with the more uplifting film. But I certainly, had my nerves slightly on edge, thinking, gosh, that something's going to happen. There's going to be some sort of backlash. But in terms of relationships, I loved how the intimacy was very deeply located in the friendships between the women. So although there is this story beautifully meanders, but there is a through line of, if you like, an inciting incident when this rice cooker arrives from the missing husband last heard of in a factory in Germany, for Prabha, the senior nurse. And then there's a sort of journey through that to her confronting what that marriage or end of that marriage or what she should do with that marriage, basically. But through it all, they all keep coming back to making a home of a certain kind for each other. And that also felt very modern to me, because that feels to me like, for lots of us, whatever else is going on for us, sexually and emotionally, that we come back to our girlfriends to have a bit of a home and a sense of acceptance, something that was, again, lost in translation, however, is the way that Anu addresses Prabha and Parvati. She does particularly see Prabha as a big sister and addresses her as such. And Prabha also makes her favourite dishes in the flat, because it gives her somebody to care for, which she loves to do, right? And so I found that incredibly touching.
It was so sisterly, even down to the hey, could you pay my rent this month? you could kind of feel that kind of sisterly and maybe there is something there as well about living in Mumbai, that they're kind of supplementary sisters, but they carve out a kind of a beautiful space. And I do think that it's lovely to see Prabha kind of move through from being kind of protectively judgmental from hearing about Anu's affair, and kind of that she's been seen about the place, kind of says something incredibly shaming to her. But as they kind of are carving out this beautiful space together, she's softening and she understands as well, so I thought that was gorgeous to see.
Important, it's something that she sees great value in, telling fictional stories in a non-fictional way, and again, there is through this line of almost social history documentation that we have in the film, you see a world where women are expected to get married and to who their parents want still, and they're expected to breed and breed and breed. At the hospital, you have Anu in this world where the government is offering 1,000 rupees and a bucket for a husband to have a vasectomy, And when the wives aren't managing to convince their men, the nurses are slipping the patient's contraception. So on that level too, there is sisterhood going on. And yet at the same time, there is something so deeply personal about each of these stories. And that's a real challenge where you've got three women and they've got these stories and making the viewer care about these stories. And I did feel that in terms of the style of the movie, the changeability of the natural world around Mumbai and Konkan, and this is set at the time of monsoon, is mirrored by the playfulness of the women when they're by themselves. So things like Anu listening to her own heartbeat with the stethoscope, and then that's alternated and echoed with playful shots of just laundry flapping on rooftops in the monsoon winds. A great deal of domestic gorgeousness and tenderness. I think you mentioned Wong Kar Wai earlier. All of this atmospherically charged by the rippling minor key, jazzy, kooky piano. So this also felt to me to be a tremendous achievement, actually. I mean, we've just talked about so many tones, right? Documentary, new wave, Wong Kar Wai, then we've got the romance, and then we've got the sisterhood. So what are we going to give it for Goddess Vote?
I'm going to give it 4.5 goddesses. Yeah, thought it was wonderful, fabulous. I don't know what else I could imagine that would give it that extra five, but 4.5.
I can tell you what it was for me. So guys, you got to see this movie. It's so beautiful. It's so unusual. It is, as Quiva has suggested, really heartwarming, especially when you're thinking about your lovely girlfriends in the most inclusive sense of that word, and everything that feminine love does for one another. At the same time, some people have loved that magical twist at the end. And I felt it kind of slightly took away from what we were building up. But it was almost like that was a tonal jump too far for me. I felt there wasn't enough space for it. And it was like, well, that's really interesting. But if you're going to take that jump, then I would have been more with you and on board if you'd flagged that earlier. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I do get what you mean. I did kind of have a like, okay, that's happening. Yeah, okay, all right. But not fully believing it as much as the rest of the film.
Exactly, but still a huge achievement. And I think a really enjoyable film to be heading into sort of winter proper here. So here in the Welsh Marches, it's been snow and it's been floods. So watching this, I felt so warmed, so delighted, so surprised. It's 4.5 goddesses from me. And how is Dublin? How's Dublin faring in the winter? And how was it watching these today at the end of November in Dublin?
It's definitely, we're feeling the cold snap now. We've had a couple of stormy nights as well, so curling up with my candles. But the chills in the air, time for pubs and bumping into friends in town.
Also I need a big sister to make me the amazing fish curry dish that I like.
Yeah, that did sound delicious.
So thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for joining us on this episode of What Goddesses Watch, where we've been talking about All We Imagine as Light and The Taste of Mango, both out on Friday, the 29th of November. Thanks, Queeve. See you soon.
Thank you.
What Goddesses Watch is produced by Soma Ghosh, with audio producer Quiva Lavelle and music by Penelope Traps. You can talk to us at Twitter at Goddess Demented, Instagram at Demented Goddess Web Scene, and you can join us as a patron and be at the forefront of film podcast making about films about and by women. That is at patreon.com/whatgoddesseswatch, or if you're listening on rss.com, hit the donate button now.